what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Leadership Leaning. And we are very excited about today's guest. You're going to love it. Again, like always, I want to say thank you so much for subscribing, commenting, posting, sharing. It means the world to me, and it's helping getting the message out about leadership and leaning into the subject. One of my favorite lines that Craig Groeschel says quite often, he's a leadership guru, in my opinion, someone I really look to. He says, when the leader gets better, everyone else does as well. Everybody gets better when the leader gets better. That's what we're trying to do with this podcast, is just get a little bit better. I have someone on here today that's going to help us in a tremendous way. Also, right after our convo, we are picking up. We chose 18 questions that we're going to answer that people wrote in and said, we're asking about this, about leadership. So we're going to blitz through 18 questions right after this talk. But please put your hands together. Maybe you're in the car, maybe at your house, maybe you're at the kitchen table. I have with me my good friend Moksha is in the house. Moksha, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
It is an honor to have you. For those of you that don't know who this incredible leader is, helped build one of the main guys that built ComplexCon and the movement of that and that whole thing. I want to kind of talk about so many insights about building a brand, building a movement. ComplexCon, being here in LA, you know, it was like everybody, right. You knew. It felt big, and everybody's driving to Long Beach. You know, you got something popping when people are driving down Long Beach.
Yeah, that was intentional.
I want to hear about that. Let's start here, though. Where did this idea, what's the genesis of it, and how did you start building it? And talk to me about the early beginning days of, you know, I see it now when it's like all over Hypebeast, all over, you know, the internet. But, you know, talking about the genesis, the beginning days.
So I'll give you the quick sort of like historical on Complex. So, I was a young sort of like, you know, aspiring business person. I was working at a media company, a magazine called The Source. It was a very hip-hop specific magazine.
My mom used to smile every time my face was up in The Source.
Yeah, you and Biggie.
Yeah, apparently. Okay. Yeah.
Five mics for you as well. So I was working there in like the late 90s, early 2000s, sort of fresh out of college.
Yep.
And I was probably super annoying and super sort of like aggressive and ambitious. And I sort of worked my way up from like admin to like a partnerships representative, basically like a salesperson. Yep. And Mark Echo and his partner, Seth Gersberg, were one of my clients. They had a fashion brand, Echo Unlimited. And through getting to know them, they had this kind of like, you know, at the time, probably like everyone poo-hooed it as like a crazy vanity driven idea that Mark had, that he felt like he was advertising in all these different periodicals and none of them really hit sort of what he called a convergence consumer, which really he was sort of identifying trends of millennials before anyone even sort of started using the term millennials.
Wow.
And he felt like there was this audience that was just as interested in hip hop as they were action sports, as they were in couture fashion, as they were in graffiti. And he felt like no one was really representing that. So you had sort of like The Source, core hip hop, GQ, core fashion, skateboarder, core skateboarder, but no one was sort of bringing all the sensibilities together. So we, in 2002, launched Complex. Actually, before we launched Complex, we launched Climate, which I think Delta or someone promptly sent us a cease and desist because they owned the name or something like that. The first version of Complex was actually on a Sony mini disc, which at the time we thought was going to scale wildly.
right.
Talk about the wrong insight there. But, you know, we sort of launched Complex Magazine, established the brand ID around that, which was around convergence culture and young people not really wanting to be sort of stereotyped or pigeonholed into one area. Like people feeling like, hey, I can be just as interested in Biggie as I am, you know, Travis Barker, and that's I can so be cool, just man. As interested in car culture as I am in streetwear or fashion or sort of high-end art or graffiti art. So sort of built Complex around that insight, around convergence culture, that, you know, sort of the magazine built, you know, it took a lot of like discipline, labor, sort of intense focus to get a print vehicle off the ground, pretty challenging business. I think both out of need and intention, we pivoted to a digital business, which was really smart. A lot of legacy print businesses didn't make that change. You know, as you see, like a lot of really iconic brands in the print space are either challenged or gone because they didn't make that transition to digital. And then, you know, sort of it was all about, Complex is always about identifying sort of subcultures or niche trends and sort of elevating and making them aware to a more mass market, and then also taking more mass things and making them culturally relevant. So it's always sort of like, we didn't want to be sort of like super inside baseball and like too cool, because cool is an exceptionally small room.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to be overly mass, because mass becomes ubiquitous, it becomes Walmart, it doesn't have cachet to it. And then so we built, you know, digital, I think, really allowed us the ability to scale and reach more people, which, to your point, sort of allowed us to, you know, the movement was like young people caring about these things. We were just highlighting them through content and having conversations with them through social and being very engaged and sort of raising up the people that were emerging, and then sort of like talking about how the bigger brands or bigger personalities were doing things that were culturally relevant. And the content and the daily cadence of content and the interaction with them on social really allowed the brand to grow. And, you know, as technology changes, you know, you go from Google being your primary sort of like path to consumers, to Facebook being the primary path, to YouTube being the primary path. Now it's a myriad of tools, TikTok, Snap, et cetera, you know, because young people are adopting new platforms all the time. Like, you know, Facebook's big challenge is like, people don't want to be on there because their grandmother's on there. And then grandmothers don't want to be on TikTok, but as soon as they are, the kids will be on to the new thing. And so, you know, we built that business over, you know, 10, 15 years before we even launched ComplexCon. And a guy named Aaron Levant came to us, who was involved with Comic-Con New York and some other big conferences. And he sort of said like, hey, what do you guys think about doing this ComplexCon? And it was more of his idea was more of like almost like a streetwear convention mixed with other music, art, et cetera. And, you know, to his credit, Mark Echo sort of saw it as like a kernel of an idea. And Mark is a huge Disney, Star Wars, Lucas fan. And he just really sort of went off and ideated on it and sort of said like, this can be something much bigger. And then when we, I think, you know, to the, particularly to like the mainstream and to like broader American sort of awareness outside of sort of that core 18 to 34 year old audience, ComplexCon really encapsulated what that previous 15 years of sort of building content, elevating the emerging.
So you needed those 15 years to really bring you into this space to be able to do this. Like, would you say that's your credibility? That brought your credibility?
Yeah, it was. I mean, Complex was really built brick by brick. Some of that was based on necessity. Like, we really, you know, it was like first, you know, Mark financed it. Then we got very minimal venture capital. So a lot of it was like, we always had to have a mind on doing things profitably, which, in, you know, if we hadn't had that lens and we had had tons of capital to deploy, we probably could have done things a lot faster, but they might not have been as meaningful. They might not have built the same amount of credibility, because going brick by brick, you do build a lot of longevity and credibility and establishment with the audience. I think we perhaps could have done it sooner, but I think it it felt like something really new, really celebratory for the audience. It felt like everything that Complex had been covering on a daily basis from a content perspective and in the social sphere, it felt like the internet in real life. Like as you are walking those halls, you're seeing, I mean, literally people.
What you've been looking at from your bedroom, it's actually here. And
you recognize people that you've never met because you've seen them on, you know, Off-White's Instagram or Nike's Instagram or wherever on Snapchat. You're like, you might, oh, that's Chad, I know him, but wait a minute, I don't really know him, but he's here. And it's like, it was, it had a massive gravitational pull from sort of like bringing talent and personalities and brands in. And then to your point before about Long Beach, that was really intentional. Like, we had considered New York and LA, but we wanted to have that suction, that gravitational pull where you, similar to the way like South by Southwest had with Austin for many years, where like thousands of people sort of like land in Austin and you're not going to leave the same day.
Right.
But if you had it in downtown LA, it's like people would pop in and out.
Oh, totally.
But if you come to Long Beach, you spent that time you invested in going there, you're going to spend some time.
You're not stopping by Long Beach.
Right. No. Yeah. There's not much else there.
Totally. Totally. My wife has this theory about parties. You know, she's always like, if we do it in a spot that people are just going to stop by and just make it one of the many things they do at that do that night, it's not going to be a good party. It's got to be like in the like the most obscure spot of the city. So like, you know, recently she threw a party in K-Town because it's like, you got to work to go to K-Town and work to find parking in K-Town. But I totally agree with that. I think that that's a genius idea. How did you get to, I want to talk about the business of hype. Because I feel like you were building, I didn't know you were building this catalog for 15 years and this credibility. And then you get there and people are walking the halls and they're seeing recognizable faces. But I feel like there is so much hype around what you were doing. And was it the stars, you know, in this cul-de-sac that you brought together? Was it the video? Was it the graphic? Like, how did you build? I just feel like you guys had a tidal wave of hype. Like even like the faith thing that you did a couple years ago. It was like, where everybody's like, what is this thing that you're doing around? How do you think about hype?
Yeah. So I think there's three things. And even with the new business that Aaron and I are doing, you know, it is all about energy, which, you know, hype can kind of be a little bit of a fleeting word. It's all about energy and connection and like the depth of connection and the depth of energy with people. But I think I was sort of thinking about it on the Lyft ride over here today, and I think there's like three key things to, like, at least from my perspective, that really help generate that depth of connection and that sort of buzz and that hype. And one, it has to be like ephemeral. So it has to be limited, almost like we were talking about with the podcast, like it's appointment viewing, right? Like, so you have to get there to see it. So if you think about ComplexCon, it's like 2 days, November, whatever the dates are, in Long Beach.
Yep.
Like, the social media strategy, if you're not there, is going to give you
crazy FOMO.
Yeah. And the content that is deployed afterwards, whether it's video or text and image based, is going to sort of reinforce that. Or the folks that were there is really going to highlight their experience and say, like, I was part of that. It was a unique, limited time experience.
That's really cool.
To your point about the faith piece, and this really, I think, goes for anything from consumer products to events, is it needs to be creatively unique, where, you know, the idea of bringing, you know, Rich Wilkerson into a space with DeRay from Black Lives Matters and Jerry from Fear of God, like, no one saw that coming.
Yep.
It was creatively unique.
Right.
It made people in a positive way uncomfortable because they didn't see it coming.
Right.
Even those guys were uncomfortable.
Wow.
Like, each one of them, you think, you know, like, you know, DeRay's, you know, the moderator, you know, like, obviously he has a very specific stance with Black Lives Matter, right, and you know, everything that he's about. And, you know, I think, you know, Jerry's got his agenda and Rich has his, and like, how does it all come together? And it was great that it was overwhelmingly positive.
Right.
But, you know, it got people to sort of like raise an eyebrow and say like, oh, wait, what are they doing over here?
Yeah.
You know, whereas there's obviously some programming that we did that was very core and was to be expected because you want to satiate the core. But if you want to create that energy and create those surprise and delight moments, you have to have things that are just like thought provoking. Yeah. So you can have sneaker of the year, who are the hottest streetwear designers, like those kind of panels, yep, those satiate the core.
Yeah.
Right. So like,
yeah,
you want to do things like that.
Sure.
But if you want to get people to, you want to get new people and you want to, sort of provoke thought, you have to do things that are creatively unique. So I think those are like some pieces that are really interesting. And then specific to big conferences like a Complex Con or even in consumer products, giving people exclusivity or first in line status, early access. You know, you probably see this all the time. Like, people want social currency, right?
Yeah.
So whether they get the new Nike Supreme drop, that's really just a form of social currency. So like,
right,
they can go around the water cooler at Zoe and be like, well, you know, people recognize them for having that product.
The new Travis Scott's what?
Exactly. Or it can be intellectual capital.
Wow.
So I was at, you know, Rich Wilkerson, DeRay, Jerry, and I learned XYZ.
Wow.
Now you have some sort of like intellectual capital and intellectual firepower.
It's really cool
that your peer group didn't have, and you're able to share with them.
I like that.
And hopefully you're adding benefit to them. But, you know, people obviously work off of ego.
Where did you find language like that? Intellectual capital. Like, what books, what exposure did you have?
I think a lot of
you create that term?
I don't know. I just thought of it right now. But I think a lot of that was wrestling to like my role in businesses has always been to help creative people commercialize their idea. Mm-hmm. So Mark and the creative team had this idea of like convergence culture, Complex Con, or even what we're doing now in network. It's a totally new concept of like entertaining video content paired with commerce. You know, it's kind of like the cool QVC for, you know, the younger generation, but it's new. So it's totally foreign to the sort of like commercial market. So those kind of terms, it's like through years of trying to explain what Complex is, like people were very comfortable with like, I know what ESPN is. Yeah. I know what GQ is. Right. I know what Sports Illustrated is. Right. I'm familiar with those things. I'm comfortable with those things. What's this new thing that some guy that, you know, got his start doing graffiti for Tribe Called Quest and then created a streetwear brand, you know, what businesses does he have in media? What is he trying to do? What are you guys trying to do? It was just like confusing to people.
Right.
So it was like, first it was explained to people like, hey, there's a new movement among young people that they don't want to be pigeonholed into these boxes.
Yep.
And we see that even more acutely expressed today, if you look at like the political climate and how young people truly don't want to be identified, even, you know, by gender or ethnicity or political sort of like disposition. You know, we were more focused on like the consumer side, where like people didn't want to be purely identified by what music they listened to, what kind of style they had, what kind of art they were interested in, you know, all of those kind of things. So, you know, sort of before we started doing it, it was like jocks, nerds, skaters,
old school,
right?
Yeah.
Punk rock kids.
Yeah.
Like there were, but they all started mashing together. The interests started to converge. And that got a lot of gasoline got poured on that fire with the internet and social media. Yep. It just made the world and culture a lot smaller and a lot more accessible. So I think it's through many, many failures of trying to explain people and trying to evangelize our business and trying to get people to invest in our business, whether that was like brand sponsors or whoever.
Yeah.
And trying to articulate why our brand mission and what we were doing could help their business and help them connect with a new audience that would be important to their business long term.
Yeah. I love that. I want to talk to you just even as you're mentioning the new stuff that you're working on. You have a proven track record of executing ideas. And so you have an idea and you see it come to pass. What are disciplines or what are values that you have when I say the word idea? How do you bring it to life in what are key steps? And when you, I'm sure you get around people, a lot of people in LA, you live in LA, New York, and Miami. These are hot spots of ideas. Ideas are happening in these cities. When you get around some people, you're like, this guy always has a great idea, but he can never follow through and he can never execute on it. What is the reason why people fail to execute their ideas? And how have you been able to take something from 2002 into what, you know, you developed it into, and then we'll talk about it in a moment, then you got out, but you brought it to this level. How do you execute?
So I think everyone has good ideas, right?
Yeah,
it's kind of like everybody's smart too.
Yeah, it's so true.
And
everyone has their own genius. That's what I believe.
Yeah. And people have incredibly good ideas. Most ideas fail through lack of consistency and lack of persistence. I know people that are ridiculously smarter than I am, but they're not willing for quality of life reasons to put in the consistent work and have the perseverance to just stick with it. Working through the hard stuff, you know, it's not for everyone. And I think to make something really successful takes any startup is hard. It takes a tremendous amount of effort. You have to have, a bit of a chip on your shoulder and have a like kind of a competitive spirit in a positive way. The world is not your enemy, but like it is competitive out there.
Right.
And you, to make these businesses, like the mission has to stay pure. So the tactics can change. Like if you think about Complex, it started as, Sony Minidisc. That was the wrong tactic.
Right.
It was the right mission, was to elevate convergence culture.
Wow.
Then print worked pretty well. The marketplace changed. Digital became the primary form of consumption and also advertising monetization. So there had to be a pivot to that. Then it became video. Now it's sort of multi-pronged. And if you don't have a mission that is consistent, coupled with consistency and persistence around execution, it won't work.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone at Snapchat yesterday, and they said something about like, perseverance, beats resistance every day.
Yeah.
And it's probably like one of those like silly slogans they have up on the wall in there,
right?
But it's really true. It's true in sports.
Yep.
And it's true in business. You know, sometimes even so-so ideas can make it if the executional team is there, and then great ideas fail every day because people don't want to put in the work that's needed. And it's not that they don't, sort of discredit them for not wanting to put on the work. It's just like they're choosing other priorities in life that are meaningful to them. And, people like me choose other things, which they wouldn't choose.
Right. So let me ask you this. So you fall in love with an idea. You're hook, line, and sinker on the idea. You're like, you're fully committed. You start building it like you've done many times over. And then you get it to the place where maybe this is what you dreamt, or even, I never even saw it this big or saw it this great. It surpassed my vision. I think that's one cool thing about leadership, is I think that sometimes you step into the genesis of an idea and oftentimes it's like, I didn't get this far in my dream. I didn't get this far in my in my vision. It's surpassed what I thought it would do, which is really cool. How do you know, let's say you walk the full length of that court, how do you know when to pivot? How do you know when to change? Because you've stepped out of complex. Yeah. You made a transition and we're like, I killed this. I created a business of hype. I got the consumer. I touched a generation. I built this great event. On and on. And then you jump off.
Yeah.
How do you know when to do that?
It's like the original goal was fulfilled. So in business, you know, the goal is, particularly when there's venture capital involved, the goal is always to exit the business, to sell it to a larger company. In the case of Complex, we sold it to Verizon and to Hearst Media. Mm. And once that was done, it was kind of like mission accomplished. Mm. And I think that was kind of always the point. It was like we had a core mission of elevating convergence culture, helping emerging talent become more established and helping bigger brands get sort of cachet. But we always felt like we could build this, and then if we could put it on into the pipes, into the platform of a bigger, you know, organization, like, you know, Verizon is one of the biggest telecommunication companies in the world,
right?
They could really add sort of like jet fuel to that and help develop other lines of business that would make it you know, sort of withstand the test of time. And if you think about Complex, it's the most important brand to, particularly to multiculturals 18 to 34 in the last 50 years. I mean, right. You know, it's like you had MTV and BET before it, and their cachet has waned. And I think, you know, we built something, and like having it grounded with two sort of iconic owners, with Hearst and then Verizon, it gives it a foundation to flourish for the next 50 years.
Yep.
So I think it's like us as sort of like entrepreneurs, our goal is always to build an exit, which is probably a bit different than the goals on your side of the table.
Yeah. But I like that, even though, you know, you cash out or you exit, you're leaving it. You're not abandoning the ship. You're leaving it in good hands. So there is legacy attached to it.
Honestly, hopefully it can do better, right?
Wow.
Hopefully they have more resources.
And how important was that to you? Like, you know, I think that's important. I wanted to stop and talk about that because I think some people would look at someone like yourself from the outside and go, built it, got it to a spot, cashed out, bounce. How important was the legacy to you before you took off?
I think it's almost like, you know, I have a 21-year-old daughter who's in college, right? And like, I think some parents like get so worried about their kids to leave and go like take on the business world. I'm so excited for it because it's like my little creation and like whatever influence I've, for better or worse, put on her.
Right.
Like, I'm so excited to see what she does when she graduates next year. So it's like that kind of spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you spend that much time on something, you have a lot of pride around it and a lot of, you know, heart for the people are there.
Yeah.
When big companies come in, a lot of people change,
yeah.
You know, like the majority of the people that I was there with since had left. There's a few there that are still doing a great job, but yeah, you want it, you know, you certainly don't want it to be the WeWork situation.
Yeah. Right?
Like,
yeah, totally.
Right. Like,
right.
Like WeWork probably, you know, no offense to anyone worked on it, but it probably doesn't exist in a couple of years, where, you know, Complex has been around for, I don't know, probably close to 20 years now. It certainly has another 20 good years ahead of it.
Well, I just think it's so different. You know, like we went and saw LeBron last night, and I was listening this morning to some people talk about how every time LeBron leaves Miami or leaves Cleveland, the team absolutely tanks without him. Like they have the worst, you know, like record setting low wins the next year. And they're talking about today, like if LeBron leaves the Lakers, what does it leave them? Thank God they have AD, but what is it? What kind of, you know, offense would they run? And the point being, in business, a little bit different than basketball. basketball, it's surrounded by a superstar, but what you created was an ecosystem. Yeah. You created culture and values that can withstand, even if you exit, you're leaving it in good hands to where it could go even further.
There's 200 plus excellent people there. Some of the people I had the, you know, honor and opportunity to work with them over 10 plus years there, who are still there and they're still thriving and killing it and growing, and they bring in new people all the time. But like a system, a mission, sort of like a set of core values was established, and they can continue to execute against those things. Obviously business dynamics change.
Yeah.
But it's that, you know, I always used to say in early stage businesses, right? If you do lose a key player,
right,
your business can be hobbled, or you know, that's why they have key man insurance on startups.
Right.
But, you know, you get to a business at the scale that is, and the foundation is strong enough to withstand anyone leaving. So maybe your key player leaves and you have to get two replacements.
Yep.
You know, maybe it can't be a one for one, but you don't go from a winning record to a losing record in one season. It just doesn't happen. If it does decline, it would be a slower decline because your foundation is there, which you see like even in, you know, any of these huge consumer product businesses, right? Yeah. Where consumer trends change, like people are calorically more conscious than they used to be. So you see those trend lines in beer or sodas where they you know, people are drinking more water or whatever lower calorie situation there is. But those businesses are fundamentally very strong.
Yeah.
So it's not like Pepsi has a problem overnight. They can, because their foundation is so strong and their business is diversified, they can work at it and try and prop up the pieces that are softening and launch new pieces to serve that new consumer need. Where if you're just, you know, if you're, you know, one team of two people and, you know, one rock star is making it all happen and something happens to that rock star, it's potentially a world of trouble.
Absolutely. You use the word values, and I want to ask you this question. So what would be your personal values as a leader? You know, you've had decades of success here in this field, so you have to have values that drive you. I always think there's this saying, manners maketh a man. I think values maketh a leader. Values drive you. And so what values do you have personally? And then, like in our cul-de-sac, it's always like, there's always like the church values and then the staff values. So there's always like a difference between like, this is what the church and the business is going to value. But here, behind closed doors, it's like
what really matters.
It's what really matters. Yeah. It's like, I always think there's the ones that are like in complex, there's ones that like the mission and we value this. But then what do you value?
Yeah.
They go, these things drive me to get up in the morning and work so hard.
Yeah. So I think I've just, you know, frankly, I've made like so many mistakes over the years. So like what I value now has probably evolved. You know, I started, you know, fortunately/unfortunately, you know, working with a team and managing a team when I was like 25 years old at Complex, which is like, in retrospect, way too young. God bless the people that put me in the position to do that, because it, you know, helped me grow. But I made a ton of mistakes, you know, and made mistakes like thinking like everyone should do and think the way I do, you know, sort of like lacking empathy for their positions and just thinking like, hey, if I do it this way and it's successful, then it will be successful. But, you know, through all of that failure, I think, you know, what's important to me for, you know, if I'm sort of in a leader position or I'm working with my colleagues who are leading other teams, I think there's like, to me, a few things that are really super important are consistency. You know, I hear it over and over again, you know, even in our new business network, it's a small team, you know, 60, 70 people, but you know, the sort of more junior staffers, they need consistency of message. Mm-hmm. So like the leaders, the department leaders, like they know the core mission. They know what we're trying to do. We're working on it every day. But it's important that consistency of mission is projected to the entire team group and the entire body of those people. So I think consistency is just, and communication and consistency is really important. I think probably I don't do enough of it, or and any leader could use to improve on that. I also think like honesty is so important, and like honesty is kind of an obvious, like people are like, yeah, don't be dishonest. But oftentimes in business and in personal communications, and that could even be, you know, spousal type things, we soften honesty, we soften directness, we avoid directness. And I've heard time and time again from either peer feedback or team feedback that people would rather hear sort of the hard truth. They'd rather know where they stand, good or bad. They don't want to think like, oh, hey, Moksha told me like A, B, C, and D, but then he told Chad D, E, and F, and those are divergent. Rather hear sort of like consistency of message and honesty around message. So I think those are two really key things. And I think those sort of like help sort of congeal the team around a central focus, a central mission, and get them sort of like, you know, you want to have a successful back to execution. In my opinion, it's kind of like you want to organize the entire team to march in the same direction. That's how you can be effective knocking down tasks that ultimately produce the results that get you to the bigger mission. Because if you have people one off and working in silos, not communicating, they might be doing great work, but they're, you know, it's like one's marching left, one marching center, one marching right. You're never getting to where you go, or it's going to be incredibly slow and painful. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think I've been, you know, sort of like learn and try to become good at is like organizing and focusing massive, at least in my opinion, massive amounts of people and pushing them in the same direction.
Yeah. But, and to be able to do that though, I always think that there's gotta be, for me to have great values in our organization and for me to have that consistency of communication, it does go back to my personal life. Like I always feel like this will never be better than this. Like my health or lack thereof shows up here. So if I have values that drive me as a leader and those are consistent, we call it the compound of consistency. When you're consistent with kindness, generosity, honesty, faithfulness, perseverance, you're consistent. You've proven that. It shows up here and there's a sense of trust. There's a sense of harmony, unity. And I feel like the we get going really fast when this is in line. You know, and these things are there. If you remove my personal discipline, this gets chaotic.
It does. And it's not always easy to stay personally disciplined and personally sort of above the fray because we get myopic in our business. Like challenges come up. You get towards the end of the day, like, you know, I'm up at 5:30 a.m. every day. By 6 p.m., I'm a little worn out. So like if some stuff happens at work that's frustrating, your reaction to that may not be as positive if it happened at 10 a.m. And watching those things and, you know, look, if, you know, I, you know, just sort of recognizing my own flaws, like I sometimes react, you know, poorly to those things. And I think it's important to sort of the point going back to values that you recognize them. You say, hey, like that wasn't the greatest reflection.
Who this, I want to be.
Sorry about that. And I'll, you know, check me on that next time. And like, here's not as an excuse, but here's why it happened. You know, I was like, well, two other things were going on and this came up and it just snapped.
Well, it reminds me of something I heard someone say, you don't have to be 100% 100% of the time. But when you need to be 100%, you need to be 100%. And by the time 6 p.m. comes, you're in decision fatigue already. You know, I think leadership is about going, these are my prime hours that I can be 100%. But, and, that's a good point. And that's, you know, that 5:30 to 9 a.m. range, that 6 to 11 a.m. range, I can't get better than that. Find me at 3:30, We might as well just go to the gym.
Yeah. You have to know yourself. Like for myself, like sometimes it's better to not answer until the next day or, hey, we'll deal with it then when we are fresh. And, you know, because, you know, everyone, you know, we all treat every situation in business and personal life like it is the most important thing of right now versus looking at it like, hey, in 6 weeks, am I going to remember this? Is this going to be super important?
Right.
And if you're not going to remember it in 6 weeks,
right,
probably not worth getting worked up over. Exactly. But if you are going to remember in 6 weeks, you better deal with it.
Then we can deal with it. Well, man, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to watching your journey to see this new idea. And, you know, I just feel like you're someone that's always going to be pushing the envelope into the new. And you've proven that. And I don't think that we're going to see anything else from your life other than extraordinary, very unique, very current. I will never call it on trend because I think you're going to create a trend. So thank you so much for
sitting down.
You're the best. All right. This month, we did something a little different. We said we're going to go to 2 podcasts a month. We're getting serious in 2020 about leadership, lean in. And we asked everyone to send in some questions. So our team went through and selected the top 18. Where we found, I don't even know what the biblical number for 18 is, but where we found 18, I don't know. These are just the top best questions. So I'm going to rapid fire here and do my best to reply to people that wrote in. And hopefully we gain some wisdom together as we talk through these. It says, number one, advice for women in ministry and preaching as a female. Well, first of all, thank you for being in the ministry and for preaching. What an honor. And advice I would have is study the best communicators. One of my favorite quotes about preaching is study yourself approved, think yourself clear, pray yourself hot, and preach yourself empty. So the first thing I'll just say is start with study. Study yourself approved. That is theology, but also listening to great, effective communicators. And I find that with communication, I want to listen to the people that I want to emulate. I really like the way that they draw history. I really like the way that they can scale. I really like the way that they can have dynamics. Not necessarily this is who I'm trying to sound like, but I like the nuances or the fragrance of their communication. So I would just say to any male or female preacher, do those 4 things and get around, listen to the best of the best. It's going to sharpen your craft. Work on your craft. Number 2, what do you do if you want to bring a concern to your leader, but you don't know if you have the place to? Well, I think your question just gave you the answer. If you don't have the place, then I would steer clear. There's wisdom right there. If you're asking yourself this question, I don't know if it's my place. Well, you just answered your own question. It's probably not your place. So then I just pray and just say, God, it's not my place. So make it somebody else's and bring in the right counsel, bring in the right person. I always think I have so much trust because the Holy Spirit is the greatest pastor in the world. And so if I can't talk to people, I just ask the Holy Spirit to go talk to people. Number 3, advice for being in ministry with your spouse. Well, congratulations. That is just awesome. I know so many successful people that are in ministry together with their spouse. I would say one of the key ingredients to, first of all, your marriage, but also to being in ministry together is respect and honor. Respect one another and honor one another. And you watch if you guys can come together in unity and harmony, it will make the ministry so easy. So try and do your best to respect and honor. And, you know, it's like Julie and I work together and I kind of just do whatever she says and I kind of go along with what she wants and life works out really well. So if you're working with your spouse in ministry, just I would treat it like such an honor. Respect them, honor them, give them a voice, give them place, give them room to speak into what you're doing. Every time I preach in the 10 a.m., the first thing I do is go to Julia and say, what do we got to edit? Did I say anything wrong? Do you like the illustrations? How can I get better? So number 4, can one ministry outgrow the church as a whole? Our youth ministry literally does everything. Well, good news for you. If you're leading that youth ministry, you are an accomplished, successful leader. So congrats. I would just say, keep going. Don't despise small beginnings and just have a sense of gratitude that you're contributing so much to the church. So have you outgrown the church? I don't know if I'd look at it that way. I don't know if that's a smart, healthy way to go, my youth ministry's outgrown the church. I would more look at it from the lens of, man, I'm really grateful that what I lead gets to contribute to such a big thing. One of my favorite lines is, I'd rather play a small part in a big thing. The problem is sometimes we think we're the big thing in a small, did I say that right? We're a big part of a small thing. In other words, you got to keep your heart humble, keep your heart grateful, and a lot of that just washes away. Keep serving. God will take care of the rest. Number five, what's a typical day in the life for you? Well, it always starts with coffee. A typical day in my life is starting off with our kids, getting them off to school, starting off with some Bible reading in the morning and some coffee and kind of getting our emails and everything in line. Then we take them to school, and then it's straight to the office, try and work. And then right when I leave the office from work, trying to go get a sweat in, get to the gym. I like to work out right before I go home, because then I'm fresh, I'm excited, I'm awake, so I can be really alert for dinner time with my family, and then go straight into bath and books and bedtime with my kids. And then once they go down, it's whatever's left over as far as work goes. I might need to grab my laptop. I might need to get on some phone calls. Or if nothing, everything's done, it's me and Julia getting to do whatever we want to do. Clean up our room, clean up the house, watch a show. That would be a typical day in my life. If I could draw it up and go, this is what I need, about 2 to 3 days a week, it's a normal day in the life. Right there, that right there, we can get a lot of work done with that schedule right there. Number six, are there ever days you don't want to be on? If so, how do you conquer those days? I was just sharing with Moksha. I heard it said, you don't have to be 100%, 100% of the time, but when you need to be 100%, you need to be 100%. So I don't feel on 100% of the time. Throughout the day, there are times where it's bursts of on, and just knowing, okay, this is a time I need to be on. I need to be on for this meeting. I need to be on for this person, on for this phone call, but I don't have to be on all day. I think you'll grow exhausted if you try and be constantly on. I think leadership is about knowing, when can I be off and when do I need to fire up and be on. Number seven, best tips for young preachers and young writers. I think the best tip that I can give any young preacher or any young writer is work on communication every day. You don't work on preaching just when you preach, and you don't work on writing just when you're putting out, you know, some publication. Every day, have the discipline. So preaching, I know that when I have coffee with someone, if I can get them to laugh and be engaged with what I'm saying right here one-on-one, that's improving my communication. Every day when I write my devotion, I'm writing it like it's going to get put out in a book, like a blog. I want to write it so effective and so well that if somebody reads this, it's like, whoa, that made so much sense, and that was such a good illustration. So in other words, work on it every single day. Number eight, what are your habits of rest? How do you stay away from burnout? I think the greatest thing you could ever give your life is a rhythm. Have a rhythm. Know when you go to bed. Know when you get up. Avoid burnout like the plague. No one is a superhero. Everyone needs the amount of sleep that is appropriate for you. So you just got to know you. I have one friend that's like, I have to sleep 8 to 9 hours every single night. I know other people are like, I only need 6 hours, and they're both genuine. You have to crack your code. So my tip to you is know your rhythm, create a rhythm, establish a rhythm. And then the best way to not burn out is by having quiet time. having a time for me. It's reading the Bible. It's time of prayer. I cannot burn out. If I sleep really good and I have that time, I will be wasted away if I don't sleep and I don't have that quiet devotion time. That's just for me personally. Number nine, how do you have conversations with volunteers about tithing? Well, that is just awesome that you want to do that. I think, again, the Holy Spirit's the greatest pastor, and so we got to pray that God starts talking to him. One of my favorite lines to say when it comes to tithing is, hey, it's not my job to ask you to give, but would you be willing to ask God, God, what would you want me, what do you have me to give? And I think that's just a great question to ask God. God, do you want me to tithe? And I would lead them to it's got to be a personal conviction. One of my favorite scriptures, every man must give what he's decided in his heart. Giving is a decision of the heart. So I can talk to someone about tithing, but ultimately they need to talk to God. God, do you want me to give? And how much do you want me to give? Your word says I'm supposed to give 10%. Do you want me to obey that? And get them in a relationship with God and talking to God. I think that solves everything. Number 10, practical way to gain volunteers in your church. How do you keep them motivated for the long haul? I think the best way to gain volunteers is to recruit them. I think if you're going to be in church, you need to become a master recruiter. And how do you keep them motivated? Well, how do you stay motivated? You got to keep the vision always out in front of us. We are motivated not by need. We are motivated by vision. I always think the church is yet in the vision. We have more vision than we have resource. We have more vision than we have people. So I got to keep pumping the vision because we're all building to what's not here today, but what's in our heart for tomorrow. Next thing. Number 11, do you get the Monday blues? Oh my gosh, on Monday, I don't even know my name. I don't even know, did we accomplish anything yesterday? Monday blues, it's like a great Sunday happens. You're like, you're up and you're ready. And it's like, wow, that was awesome. It's usually, unfortunately, attached to attendance. It's so petty. But the Monday blues happens when it's not happening the way you want. And that was not a good day. And why did that not work? And the Monday blues are inevitable. I think you got to learn how to not have overreaction Monday. Overreaction Monday is you come in on Monday and you're like, we're changing this, we're changing that. No, no, no. Let's sleep on it and let's see how we feel on Tuesday. But I know so many people that have the Monday blues, of course. How do you deal with criticism? It's a great thing because I get criticized quite often. Criticism is inevitable. I think, remember, the more you step out, the more you become a target for criticism. If you don't want to be criticized, do nothing at all. Criticism happens when you're moving forward and you start to have some effectiveness around your life. Just a heads up, people are going to make fun of you. They're going to create fake accounts about you. They're going to, you know, laugh at you. And it's just a part of this whole thing. So I hold to Jesus' words. They're like, Jesus goes, listen, if they hate me, they're going to hate you. So leading for God kind of comes with this whole connotation that being light and being salt and being someone that carries the gospel is going to come with some hate. It's just part of, and even hate from our own cul-de-sac and our own community. So how do I deal with criticism? I try and just not let it go to my, I try and not let praise go to my head and criticism go to my heart. How do I keep both of those? Listen, don't read your own press clippings. You're not that great. And don't take criticism too seriously. Maybe take some truth out of, maybe there is some truth we need to take from the criticism. But if not, just haters are going to hate. I'm not driven by what they say. I've got to be driven by my values and what God wants me to do. So it just kind of is what it is. How to combat a competitive spirit among team of leaders. Oh, I dislike this. My job is to celebrate everyone on my team. I don't, the competitive spirit thing is like, you want to compete with people on our team. What a shallow soul. What a crazy mindset. What a small spirit. I don't have any room for it. I would never tolerate that on our team. If you want to compete with other people on our team, just like, that's not, it's not okay. It's not cool. And there's something broken in that person. So I just call it out. Listen, people with a competitive spirit usually are insecure, and around insecure people, they want us to walk around them with eggshells. No. We're going to stomp on those eggshells, call them out, because that stuff that lurks in the dark could destroy our team. So don't allow it. You combat that. Throw it out there in the middle of the room and go like, hey, you're being weird. Don't do that. Next one, number 14. When you started Zoe, what are some things you do differently and some things you're glad you did? What are some things I did differently? I would have hired staff quicker. I think we were a little bit slow to hire because we just were watching the money, you know, your new startup. I think I would have hired for growth rather than once we grew. I think we hired a little bit late. And some things that I'm glad that we met every Tuesday night for 9 months and got ready with the DNA and the culture and the values and the vision of this house and the mission. So when we launched the church, it was strong. The team was strong. The culture was strong. Felt like an established church because we had been getting this thing ready for 9 months. I'm so glad we took our time with that. Number 15, how do you help old leadership teams get behind new vision? That's a great question. And I find this to be one of the hardest things in leadership. Not that I've had tons of experience with it, but talking with people that take over churches, older congregations, older established, that old regime, that old guard, it is really hard for people to get along with new vision. So I would just say, wait it out. Time tells. Sometimes, you know, it's like I had a friend take over a church and he said for the first 3 years, it was like off-roading, you know, it's just hard. And, you know, so-and-so's leaving and so-and-so's offended and so-and-so doesn't like it. And so the changes and blah, blah. And, but after about 3.5 years, it was like, he said they got off of the, you know, the Jurassic ride and onto the freeway. So I would just say, be patient, wait it out. Time's going to change everything. Stick to your guns and stick to the vision. Number 16, how do you take the lead when you're a passive person? Wow. How do you take the lead when you're a passive person? I would say it's okay if you're passive, because if you're yourself, everything will work out. Just don't be passive aggressive. Be passive, that's fine. If you defer, you let others lead. I think the most important thing about leadership is being yourself, being secure. And even if you're passive, there's room and there's grace for that. I know so many effective, great leaders that are kind of passive by nature. They're not like alpha. And it really works as long as you're secure and you're yourself. Number 17, how do you lead when you're one of the youngest in the room? Great, great question. Timothy comes to mind, right? Don't let anyone despise your youth. Don't let anyone despise your age. Set the bar, set the example. So what are you setting the bar in? Your speech, your faith, your purity. You are the gold standard. So you don't need to be a certain age. Jesus is 12 in the temple and they are like, who is this? So set the bar. Come dressed excellent. Let your speech be filled with truth and grace. You know, have an edge, have an excellent spirit about you. And it doesn't matter if you're the youngest in the room. All that matters is that there's a spirit of excellence and kindness, and you got the right character and the right values that are driving your leadership. Now, last one, number 18, we did it. How do you steward influence without a platform? That is a great question. Well, first of all, if you have influence, you have a platform. You are the platform. I always think this is very important, because a lot of people think my platform is my influence. Well, let's take Bishop Jakes. If you take Potter's House away from Bishop Jakes, does he still have a platform? The answer is yes, because his influence is the platform. So if you have influence, your name who you are is an influence. So I would just say, don't worry about the platform. The platform is God's business. God will give you a mic when he wants to. God will give you a stage when he wants to. All that's God's. God gives invitation. God gives promotion. Promotion cometh not from the east nor the west. Promotion cometh from the Lord. All that. So I'm not worried about platform. I'm always careful about being a good steward of my influence. Guys, we did it. 18 questions. Hey, thank you so much for sending those in. That was a lot of fun. And I hope that you enjoyed it. We love you. And we are believing over your life as a leader that you would get a sense of the wind of heaven at your back. I love that terminology, wind of heaven, the wind of heaven at your back. And you're growing in grace, you're growing in knowledge, and God is doing more in you and through you than you could ever ask, think, or imagine. We love you. We're for you. We'll see you next time on Leadership Lean In.
Do you ever feel like you want to know more about the Bible, but that it's kind of hard to understand? Do you want to share your faith with your friends, but have a hard time figuring out how to do that? Do you want to learn how to connect the Bible to your real life? Well, then this is the show for you. My name is Rachel, and I'm your host. I've been a children's pastor for a long time, and one of my favorite things is helping kids learn how to understand the Bible. I think that sometimes people think that the Bible is just for adults, but God actually really wants kids to know about him. So on this podcast, we're going to learn all about God's big story and how he shows himself to us through the Bible. As we learn together what the stories in the Bible mean, we can learn how to live out our faith in our everyday life. Don't forget to subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode.
My name's Preston Sprinkle, and I host the Theology in the Raw podcast. Theology in Raw aims to help believers to think Christianly about theological and cultural issues by engaging in curious conversations with a diverse range of thoughtful people. I have conversations with a wide range of different guests who come from different perspectives, and no topic is off limits. Sexuality, abortion, politics, LGBTQ, warfare, violence, marijuana, immigration, you name it. If you have a theological or cultural issue that you have been wrestling with over 1,100 episodes, we've probably talked about it on Theology in the Raw. Along with conversations with various people, I also address questions sent in from my audience every month. And occasionally, I will talk about some of my latest research projects that I'm currently working on. Theology in the Raw is not for everyone. It is uncut, uncensored, and I don't give trigger warnings. So check out Theology in the Raw through your favorite podcast app.